First of all, always install those software security patches, am I right? Also, global trade, much like nature, abhors a vacuum. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday the 15th of May, good as always to have you along, everybody. Here is the thing about the cyber attack that much of the planet is in the middle of. The ransomware known as WannaCry that's infected computers in more than 150 countries so far. It's been remarkably unprofitable for the perpetrators. Ransomware, of course, is all about a ransom in return for liberating a victim's computer files. In this case, payment has been demanded using the virtual currency Bitcoin. To date, though, security experts say only about $55,000 worth of Bitcoin has been paid. Marketplace's Amy Scott gets us going with why Bitcoin is the cyber criminals' currency of choice.
If you want to extort money from people all over the world, a decentralized digital currency like Bitcoin makes sense.
The efficiency of the network, I think, is what criminals are really using it for here.
Peter Van Valkenburg is director of research at Coin Center, a cryptocurrency advocacy group.
It's electronic cash, so it's easy to write software that can automatically demand payment and automatically verify that payment has been made.
There's a big downside for criminals, though. Every single Bitcoin transaction is recorded in a public ledger known as the blockchain. Gina Peters is an economics professor who studies Bitcoin at Trinity University. She says hackers can anonymously set up virtual wallets to receive Bitcoins from their victims, but
we know the three wallet numbers that these payments are being sent to, which means that they can now be watched online. And I'm watching them right now.
And you can, too, at blockchain.info. Brian Knight is a senior fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. If hackers try to spend their bitcoins or cash out into a local currency, he says they could eventually be caught.
If you know enough about the other points in the transaction chain, you may be able to pinpoint who or what is behind that particular account.
So bitcoins may be easy to receive, but harder to spend. As of late this afternoon, payments continued trickling in, but no money was moving out. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Two more quick things about Amy's story. First of all, Reuters reports this afternoon security companies are looking at a North Korean-linked group as the perpetrators. Also, should you be curious, item number two, the Bitcoin exchange rate is about 1,700 to the dollar. All right, moving on. Today in the law of supply and demand, oil, two of the world's biggest producers, that'd be Russia and the Saudis, have confirmed they will, in fact, extend their supply cuts into early next year. That's about 3 months longer than had been expected. Capitalism being capitalism, prices jumped more than 2% by the close today. But here's the thing. We are talking about, in the grand scheme of things, a relatively itsy-bitsy supply cut. Yet, history teaches us that that's often all it takes to move prices quite a bit. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong explains why.
If the store's running out of strawberries and the price goes up, you buy apples. If the restaurant runs out of fish, you pick chicken. If gas gets scarce, you still buy gas. You got to commute and you're stuck with it, at least in the short term, says Sheila Chinkle, visiting economist at Emory University.
If you have a gas-guzzling car, you know it's going to cost you a lot more. But if it only has 10,000 miles on it, you're not about to suddenly sell it.
Multiply this by a billion cars in the world, and a small shortage can lead global demand to outrun supply and prices spike. By one measure, a 1% cut in oil boosts prices up to 25%. That's the math of Ed Herz, oil executive and econ professor at the University of Houston.
For example, if there's a geopolitical event that takes 10% off of the world market, we could see the price jump, you know, well above $250 a barrel in the short run.
That's five times where we are now. Geeks call this inelasticity, the cost of our addiction. We're just not flexible to deal with shortages. And nor are we with oil gluts. 3 years back, OPEC kept pumping oil, as did the Americans and the Russians, and we had too much.
And that just kept accumulating and accumulating, and that's what really pushed prices down.
Jamie Webster at the Center of Global Energy Policy at Columbia says there's no good way to eat up extra gasoline.
You're not going to commute to work twice, no matter how cheap the gasoline price is.
Historically, this is a big reason oil prices are so volatile. One little misstep in the dance between supply and demand, and prices flip out. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
2017, as we all know, is going to be written about in the history books for a whole lot of reasons. One of them, though, might well turn out to be this year as a tipping point in the global economy. This weekend, Chinese President Xi Jinping hosted a summit in Beijing to push his infrastructure plan. It's called One Belt, One Road. He wants to boost the trade ties between China, Asia, Africa, and Europe. In this country, meanwhile, the official policy is America First. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is already history, and NAFTA hangs in the balance. Marketplace's Adam Ellington has the rest of that.
By almost any reading, China's One Belt project is the most ambitious global development initiative since the Marshall Plan, a $1 trillion infrastructure scheme that would build highways, pipelines, and railroads in over a dozen countries across Asia. And that's just fine, says Brookings economist David Dollar.
Yes, I don't really see that we lose from the One Belt project. U.S. firms will be involved to some extent.
Dollar points out that many of China's investments in things like ports and power plants in developing countries could also benefit the United States, what he calls trade development 1.0.
It's really very basic, liberalizing trade in manufactured products, investing in infrastructure in the way that the World Bank has done traditionally. So I see it very much as a traditional agenda.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership, however, which the Trump administration pulled out of, that was trade development 2.0, involving things the U.S. does have a big stake in, such as intellectual property and the growing service economy. Daniel Rosen at the Rhodium Group think tank says we should be cheering for One Road to be a success. For one, it will signal China is solidly on the path toward trade liberalization, though, he says, problems remain.
A lot of things need to change, and a lot of new skills need to be developed, and a lot of bad old habits of just throwing money out the door very quickly are going to have to be altered to get to that happy outcome.
China must invest its money wisely in projects with real economic value, Rosen says. Otherwise, it could be on the hook for a lot of bad debt from poor countries not able to repay the loans they took out to fund the infrastructure upgrades the One Road requires. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, up arrows all the way around. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The restaurant business can be tough. Low margins, sometimes demanding customers, long hours as well. But if you were opening a restaurant today in Nashville, Tennessee, you'd have a lot of competition. The number of bars and restaurants in that city has risen by almost a third over the past decade. And so as you get set for your grand opening, you'll also quickly realize you're not competing just for customers, but for staff as well. Emily Siner from WPLN in Nashville has the story.
Workmen recently installed floors and sinks in the building that is now home to a restaurant called Lulu. Cardboard boxes filled with dishwasher racks and food processors are piled high against the window.
What we're waiting on right now are just some inspections.
Miranda Whitcomb-Ponce is the owner of Lulu.
Then we can start cooking things. So everything will happen really rapidly at this point. Right now looks like chaos.
Whitcomb-Ponce is a serial entrepreneur in the Nashville restaurant scene. She helped open a popular burger joint, a local coffee chain, an upscale American restaurant, and now this fast casual place specializing in salads and grain bowls. And she knows, besides the food and floors, one other thing that needs to be ready, a staff. So she hired Mater Scott to put together the team. Scott's worked in Nashville restaurants for the past decade and a half, and she's seen this part of the process from the other side as a former server.
Every time a restaurant opens, if you have any decent amount of experience, people will approach you all the time.
Now, she's doing the approaching. She pitches Lulu to potential employees as more than a restaurant, instead as a supportive workplace where people can let their creativity shine. This intrigued Rachel DeYoung, who's one of the first hires. DeYoung is a chef who trained at Le Cordon Bleu in Paris and says for a long time, the industry had a bad rap as one that was hard to work in.
Largely, I think in the past, it sort of held a mentality that you did whatever had to be done. And that could mean 18-hour days. That could mean not eating. That could mean standing and not drinking water forever. It could mean emotional and verbal abuse.
And restaurants didn't used to offer many financial incentives either, says Nate Gifford. He's a butcher who runs his own bacon company, and he moved here 8 years ago to be a line cook.
If someone not in the industry was like, you have health insurance, do you have benefits, do you have retirement, and line cook, we would laugh. We would be like, no, we don't have insurance. We're lucky to have jobs.
Now, at least in Nashville and other booming restaurant cities, the dynamic has flipped. Gifford says workers can afford to turn places down.
It's like, you don't have insurance? Maybe I'll pass. because this guy has insurance. Now I can be a line cook and feed my family, have health insurance, maybe even retirement.
Wages are going up too. Claire Crowell is the president of a trade organization called Nashville Originals. She says her servers used to make $15 to $18 an hour with tips. Now they routinely make $22, even $30. In other words, it's a good time to be a restaurant employee. But Crowell says owners are having a harder time.
The labor market has been really stretched thin for the restaurant industry. We feel it in our own restaurants, but that's the number one cause of concern for our restaurant members in the Nashville Originals.
And they don't just have to recruit, they also have to retain. Because in this tight market, newcomers might try to snag your best employees. Maider Scott at Lulu flipped through her mental Rolodex when hiring staff. For instance, her top manager had just left a high-end restaurant, Fifth and Taylor, where Scott used to work too.
So I met him there. And then I worked with Kasana at Adele's. Belle came from Fifth and Taylor as well.
Scott bristles at the word poaching to describe this practice.
I'm not stealing anyone. Like, I'm offering them a better way of life.
The key, then, is for Nashville restaurants to offer a way of life so attractive that their employees don't want to leave. Because otherwise, they can. In Nashville, I'm Emily Seiner for Marketplace.
A couple of weeks ago, I did a quick final note about how some companies in this economy are paying their interns close to six-figure salaries. Turns out we have a listener who was just such an intern, and he is today's installment of our series, My Economy. His name is David Koons, and when he was a PhD student at the University of Oregon, well, he found himself looking for a job.
The internship job description that I found because I was searching for cognitive neuroscience. So it was 11, 12 years of education at that point before I even could get that internship. You could have someone that is doing world-class research in artificial intelligence or deep learning, but they're all quote-unquote interns. We do need highly skilled individuals. That type of education is required to do a lot of this type of work. I do feel a little bit embarrassed about my salary because it is far above what most people make. I know that by looking at the statistics. It also makes me keenly aware that I do live in a bit of a bubble because among my peers that I socialize with, it's not that unusual. I think people deserve what I have because I don't feel like I live a lavish lifestyle. I have a pretty modest home. We have the retirement savings that we should have at our age, but it's way more than what people do have. Same with our salaries. It's way more than the median or the mean. But at the same time, that just basically covers what we should have to live the stereotypical middle-class lifestyle.
That was David Koons. We got him in Portland, Oregon. Take a second, would you, and tell us your story? You can do it at marketplace.org/myeconomy. Coming up.
Sometimes casino tries something and then it fails. And then you see that reflected in the next casinos.
Not all casino architects hit the jackpot, you know. First, though, let's do the numbers. Yeah, I don't know. Global computer attack, and yet the markets didn't even care. Dow Industrial's up 85 points today, 0.4%, 20,981. NASDAQ up 28 points, 0.4%, 6149. The S&P 500 up 11, 0.4%, 2402. Cybersecurity companies did all right. Symantec gained 3.1% today. Palo Alto Networks added 2.7%. FireEye up 7.5% today. Today's Might Have Heard is the 20th anniversary of Amazon's initial public offering. $10,000 invested in Amazon 20 years ago, figured the Wall Street Journal, worth $4.9 million today. Of course, that wouldn't count today's loss. Amazon off about 0.3%. You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood.
On our podcast, Make Me Smart, we ask our guests this.
What is something you thought you knew, but you later found out you were wrong about?
If you play by the rules, you win.
Hard lessons from Elevest CEO Sally Krawchuk. Stunning realizations, though, from TV legend Norman Lear.
I wouldn't have said that I was capable of murder.
Trust me, you got to hear that story.
Yeah. And of course, a really important lesson about livestock from the CEO of Reddit.
I thought that a pony was a baby horse.
Turns out it's not. It's just a small horse. Come join the conversation at marketplace.org/makemesmart.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There are things that happen in business and the economy that don't always make a whole lot of sense, which we get, and which is why we started a whole series called I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer, by brain work and leg work.
The questions usually do come from listeners, but we've got some of our own as well, like today's, why is it that the car rental industry is so different from the rest of the travel business? Marketplace's Rima Kreis got that one.
Just about everyone has a friend who's a flake. You know, the one person you can depend on to cancel at the last minute. For the purposes of this story, I am that flake.
Are you looking for a location that is in the U.S., in Canada, or international?
That friendly automated person is trying to help me reserve a car for June from Avis.
Which airport or city and state?
LAX, Los Angeles.
All right. Lexington Bluegrass Airport.
No. LAX. Okay, won't put you through that. Eventually, I get routed to a human, Joe Garcia, and I book a Ford Fiesta for 5 days.
You pay at the counter.
And what if I have to cancel last minute?
Okay, no problem. There ain't going to be no extra fee or nothing.
This is what I love about the rental car industry. No cancellation fees, no punishment if I bail, no mortgage payment, like when I want to change my flight or I'm not feeling my Airbnb. In fact, I could go online right now and book 10 reservations at 10 different car rental companies.
And then, you know, you can go to the line that's shortest and take that booking and just leave the others by the wayside.
Or leave all of them by the wayside, says Chris Brown of Auto Rental News. So how did this little island of forgiveness survive in such an unforgiving travel industry? John Healy follows the rental car industry for North Coast Research. He says, back when the business began, auto manufacturers, Ford, General Motors, owned car rental companies. They used them as a way of getting some payoff for models they overproduced and couldn't sell.
Some rental car operators thought about their business not in terms of making money on renting the cars, but from an alleviation of stress on the manufacturing side of the business.
But they're thinking about making money now, especially since no-show rates are easily above 20%. And companies that use third-party sites like Expedia and Kayak pay about $5 per reservation, whether people show up or not. That's roughly $15 million down the drain every year. Even so, the industry isn't likely to start hitting customers with cancellation fees, says Healy, because that would require all the players to act together.
Some rental car companies have been afraid to charge for no-shows with the fear that their competitors won't, and it would be used as a marketing campaign against them.
The closest the industry has come is prepaid reservations, where you get a cheaper deal but pay a stiff penalty if you bail. Another way companies try to protect themselves? Overbook. But if their estimates are off, they may end up doing the unthinkable, point customers to the competition, like Mark Dufresne.
We have a pretty good variety of cars. We have convertibles like the Beetle.
Dufresne owns Marathon Car Rental here in Los Angeles. Standing in his small lot, he says, during the summer,
we'll get calls from people standing in line at the airport at car rental companies going, I have a reservation and I've been standing in line for 3 hours. And
please tell me you have a car. Dufresne says sometimes customers practically beg him to take their credit card information when they reserve.
Customers feel sometimes that by giving their credit card, they're guaranteed to have a car.
But he says it doesn't make a difference. So flakes, rejoice. Your friends may get mad at you, but rental car companies, they won't hold a grudge. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
This series works best if you all send us your questions. Hit us up at marketplace.org. Love it or don't, Las Vegas, Nevada is one of America's iconic cities. And there are few cities anywhere that have changed so much and so quickly in such a short period of time. The buildings and hotels on the Las Vegas Strip in particular, which have been built and torn down, or imploded more likely, as American demographics and society have changed. Stefan Aul is an architect and an urban planner. He teaches at the University of Pennsylvania, and his book about the topic at hand is called The Strip, Las Vegas and the Architecture of the American Dream. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Without taking anything away from the actual writing and the work that's in this book, the cover and the front end paper are amazing. Just these representations of the kinds of buildings, the places they were built on the Strip, the scale. It's sort of, it's a little bit archaeological. You know what I mean? Going back to like 1941.
Yeah, and thanks for that. I actually designed the cover myself. So, you know, I literally gone back into the archives and dug deep into the floor plans of all the individual casinos when they were first built.
Huh.
And there's a total of 42 really large casinos that were built over the 70-year period since the Strip was founded. If you trace these and if you look at the blueprints, if you look over time, there's a clear evolution. Sometimes, you know, a casino tries something and then it fails. And then you see that reflected in the next casino. So there's a very interesting natural evolution that occurs on the Strip.
It also, you say in this book, as the 50s and 60s came to pass, it incorporated this idea of gambling sort of into suburbia, right, as Las Vegas grew, and thus sort of incorporated sin and the American dream all into one big thing.
Yeah, I think this was really a fascinating period. So after the Second World War, a lot of soldiers that returned from the war, they didn't move back to the cities. They moved to the suburbs. So there's a nationwide push for suburbanization. And this American dream that gets manufactured then is the single-family home. It's having your own pool. And this is precisely the image that developers then started to hijack. So they built these casinos the shape of a bungalow on steroids with clean modern forms, but also with a pool. And the pool became a really important status symbol for resorts, and they competed with pools. So every new pool had more elaborate shapes. One of the pools, the most famous one in the Sands, had a floating crab staple and a poolside slot machine. So
there's a great picture in the book of that crab staple. It's fabulous.
So in a way, it rode on the trend, but at the same time, what it did, it encapsulated gambling in this image of suburbia.
And then just as an indicator of how Vegas continually reinvents itself, there comes a time like 20-ish years ago where it becomes Disneyfied, and it's a place you go with your kids for a vacation and wholesome family entertainment.
The Disney Corporation during the time was the most or the world's largest entertainment corporation. And Vegas developers wanted to tap into this demographic of baby boomers that travel with their children. And as a result, they started to build these larger-than-life Cinderella castles like the Excalibur, which is almost a literal copy of Cinderella Castle. When they found out that families who travel with their children actually don't spend as much as when they travel without their children.
Right.
And very soon there was a backlash, and all these Disney-style attractions, or a lot of them, were being demolished, and casinos were redeveloped for the next best thing.
Which gets us now in a kind of a roundabout way to City Center and MGM, which is sort of, I guess, the latest and greatest thing in Vegas now, right?
City Center is the United States' most expensive private development at $10 billion. And it's a completely different era in terms of architecture, but also in terms of demographic. They're no longer going after families, but really after millennials. And millennials don't like to gamble as much as their parents.
Hmm.
So they're giving them other things like shopping, Broadway shows, nightclubs. It's really significant how the Strip has once again evolved the past 10 years.
Stefan Aul is an architect. He is also a professor of urban design at the University of Pennsylvania. His book about Las Vegas is called The Strip, Las Vegas and the Architecture of the American Dream. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks, Guy. Really enjoyed it.
final note on the way out today, about which you can mark me down in the no column. The National Basketball Association has approved corporate logos on uniform jerseys for a 3-year trial starting next season. 2.5 inches by 2.5 inches on the front left of game jerseys because what? NBA teams don't make enough money, right? Yes, professional sports are a business. I get that, but still. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 85 points today, 0.4%. NASDAQ up 28 points, 0.4% as well. S&P 500 up 11 points. Wait for it, 0.4%. Bridget Bonner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios get the show on the air every day. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.